Welcome back to Closing the Gap, a podcast on gender bias in medicine. I'm Amber Sobrario, an emergency physician in San Antonio.
And I'm Laura Smiley, an emergency physician in Detroit. This podcast series is brought to you by our sponsors, Medical Center Emergency Services, a not-for-profit Democratic Emergency Medicine Group in Detroit, and Feminem.
The views expressed are those of the author and do not reflect the official views or policy of the Department of Defense or its components.
This is the final episode of Season 1 of Closing the Gap. So far, we've framed some issues for women in medicine today. We've heard how women broke into medicine and how far we've come. We've learned about gender bias and how it's likely a huge contributing factor to the problem women physicians face today. We heard some compelling evidence to support fixing these issues, and we know it's not only the right thing to do, it's also better for business. Our entire focus so far has been on how gender bias affects physicians in the workplace. But what about our patients? Does our implicit bias trickle into how we make diagnostic and therapeutic decisions?
Well, the short answer is yes, but lucky for you, we're also going to give you the long answer that has evidence to back it up. Gender bias significantly contributes to a health gap between men and women. Serious diagnoses and treatments are frequently delayed or missed in women, leading to adverse outcomes. Most of the time, women's symptoms are attributed to hysteria or anxiety. However, the research behind this shows that as healthcare providers, we're completely missing the boat when it comes to women. And sidebar, do you know where the term hysteria comes from? Think about where else you have heard the root of this word. Does hysterectomy sound familiar? Well, that's because it was thought from the beginning of medicine that women's mental issues came from their uterus.
Funny, or maybe not so funny, that this term persists in medicine today. Anyway, back to the topic at hand. There are so many studies out there demonstrating the health gap between men and women. For example, a study published in New England Journal of Medicine in 2000 showed that women are 7 times more likely than men to be misdiagnosed and actually discharged in the middle of having a heart attack. That was 19 years ago, and this disparity still exists. More recent studies have shown that even after using objective measures to risk stratify patients, including TIMI scores, presenting complaints, and EKGs, women are still less likely to receive appropriate testing and treatments in the ED than men. So why does this keep happening?
Well, like almost everything, it's multifactorial. Most research has shown that women are disadvantaged because inadequate attention to the research, diagnosis, and treatment of women's healthcare problems. And this is likely related to implicit bias and the lack of research data on women's health. Prior to 1990, almost all of the medical research out there was conducted on men, and mostly white men. But the results of this research has since become a dogma in medicine. We have generalized these results and applied them to populations that were not studied, like women, for example. The original research on prophylactic value of aspirin and coronary artery disease was derived almost exclusively from research on men, yet the recommendations on this research are generalized to both genders. Now, we're not advocating to withhold aspirin from women, but what we do want to focus on is the difference between the populations. And as more research comes out, we're finding that women and men present differently and respond differently to treatment. However, women's symptoms are still brushed aside as anxiety or hysteria, which is leading to detrimental outcomes shown by the research from our own specialties academic societies.
Another study released in 2008 in the journal Academy of Emergency Medicine showed that women are more likely to wait for analgesia when compared to men in the emergency department. 65 minutes compared to 49 minutes. And women with pain are more likely to receive sedative medications or antidepressants to treat their psychogenic pain than actual painkillers as compared to men. Women have significant delay in diagnosis of chronic illness, TB, sleep apnea, and many types of cancer, and even brain tumors compared to men, sometimes by more than 10 months because their symptoms are often mistaken as being all in their head. Once diagnosed, they're more likely to suffer from chronic pain that's undertreated as compared to men as well. So do no harm is the oath that we take, but research shows that we consistently still let gender bias get in the way of taking care of our patients. And we should point out, both men and women are the perpetrators of this bias.
We also see bias affecting patient care when it comes to race, sexuality, disability, and socioeconomics. Out of all those things, gender has the strongest correlation to delays in diagnoses and treatment. Also, these biases can be synergistic, leading to even worse discrimination in patient care for women of color and other underrepresented minority groups.
We can quote studies all day on this topic, and please see our show notes for more information. I think a better illustration of this is our guest today, Dr. Teresa Smith. Dr. Smith completed her undergraduate studies at Spelman College in Atlanta, attended NYU School of Medicine, and completed her EM residency at NYU Bellevue. She did an ultrasound fellowship at SUNY Downstate, Kings County, where she is currently the resident program director of the largest emergency medicine training program in the U.S. She is well known for her teaching skills and mentorship. She additionally completed a Master's of Medical Education at the University of Pennsylvania. She's received many outstanding achievement awards, and most recently, she was named the GME Program Director of the Year in 2018. She's here with us today to discuss her experiences as a patient. She has a unique perspective given her outstanding qualifications as a physician, as well as a person who has been diagnosed with a chronic illness. Thank you for joining us and sharing your story. I listened to your Fix Talk, which was so outstanding. You know, as a woman, like, for example, MIs are frequently missed in women because our complaints tend to be atypical. And so sometimes our complaints of chest pain or discomfort or difficulty breathing are attributed to emotional hysteria or anxiety. I know that you went through a pretty significant illness. Did you feel that you were being heard? And if you weren't, do you think that that had something to do with either your race or your gender or both?
So this is a very difficult question for me because I look at it from both the viewpoint of a patient and the viewpoint of a physician, and it's difficult. As a patient, there has definitely been times where I've been discriminated against, I think less so because of my race, but more so because I was a woman and this, you know, concept of hysteria. Even more than hysteria, I think I was probably treated definitely, you know, better than most patients because by the time I was diagnosed, I was a medical student. And so just carrying that badge of being, you know, within the medical field gave me much more privileges that I think most of our patients get. But I think the medical decision making and the autonomy was where people judged me harsher. And so I can tell you of an incident where I was admitted, and I've been admitted many, many times. I was admitted and my dad was visiting me. And I had basically, and I speak about this in Fix, I am not the most compliant patient, even to this day. And I was tired of taking steroids. As someone who suffers from multiple autoimmune diseases, you know, steroids is forever, they are forever going to be in my life. But I had been on a huge amount of steroids for many months, and I was just tired of it. For anyone who has been on steroids, you'll know that in the very beginning, when you first start, you have all of this energy to the point where I feel like I'm almost manic a little bit, and you just feel great because you were feeling awful before, and now you're getting treatment. And so now some of your inflammatory, you know, symptoms are going down. But then the longer you stay on steroids, you feel awful. You don't feel like yourself. Between the weight gain to, you know, growing hair on your chin to just not feeling like yourself. And so I stopped. I got fed up and I just stopped. Now, we all know we're doctors, and I was a pretty senior medical student at that time. And so, of course, I knew of adrenal insufficiency, but I didn't care at that point, and I just stopped. And I went into adrenal insufficiency and ended up being admitted to the hospital. So when this medical resident came in, he was disturbed that I was a medical student, pretty senior medical student. I believe probably I was in my third year, maybe almost entering my fourth year. And he was like, how could you just stop the steroids? You know, you basically put yourself into adrenal insufficiency. And I said, I know, but I can't take it anymore. And if I'm going to have to deal with this illness for the rest of my life, then my quality of life is just as important as treating my medical illness. And at this point, I am not living a good quality of life. And so I decided to stop until I could figure out what I could do to compromise my treatment and my quality of life. And so being an analytical person, clearly he just did not understand that thinking. And he said, but you could die from adrenal insufficiency. You need to take the steroids. And so I said, no, I would prefer to speak with my rheumatology private attending before making that decision to take the steroids. He decided to talk to my father. And then the entire conversation went directed at my father, and he just stopped talking to me. He looked at my father. He talked to my father. He said, you need to tell her to take the steroids. And he just proceeds to talk to my father. Now, my father knows me and my personality, and that made my father extremely uncomfortable because he knows how much of an independent woman he taught me to be. And so he really wasn't saying much. He just kept looking at me so that he was hoping the doctor would get the clue to address me and not him. However, this gentleman just kept going on as if my father was going to make the decision for me. And finally, you know, I let this go on for about 20 minutes or longer. And I finally was like, why are you talking to him? He's not the patient and he's not going to make the decision. You need to address your concerns to me. And he said something like, well, you're being impractical and clearly not making the right decision. So I'm hoping that he'll make the decision for you. And I was infuriated and I asked him to leave the room. And before he left, he said again, you know, you could die of adrenal insufficiency. And I said, yeah, that's true. And I very well know that, but I'm not going to die before 5 p.m. when I talk to my rheumatologist. So thank you and goodbye. And so he left. And so I remember that one incident of feeling like as a woman, he completely was trying to take all of my autonomy and my power to care for my own self and make decisions about my treatment plan for myself. And he was trying to give it to my father, whom he thought had better judgment than me, even though my father was not experiencing the symptoms that I was feeling. At the end of the day, I ended up compromising with my rheumatologist, and we ended up decreasing the amount of steroids with a goal of tapering myself off of it. But I really had to be my own advocate in that moment. And so I felt like I was discriminated against, not so much for my race, but for my gender. And that's with all of the medical knowledge I had gained at that point. I can't even imagine what happens to women who don't have that medical knowledge or who are not empowered to be their own advocates. They are not listened to. Their symptoms are dismissed as hysteria, or my cry at that moment was, I need a better quality of life. I have a chronic illness. I cannot live this way. And if I have to live this way, then life is not worth living for me. And that's what I had gotten to at that point. And I think that instead of being demanding and saying, this is what the textbook says that your treatment is, this is how I'm going to cure you, I think as physicians, we really need to sit down and ask ourselves, why is this patient acting this way? And ask our patients, why are you acting this way? Why are you not being compliant with the treatment plan? There's so much underneath that question that you'll find out. And I think it would really improve your rapport with your patients. On top of the fact, if you can come to a compromise with your patient, patients will be much more compliant with the treatment plans. And it may not always be that what you're doing is what the textbook says is correct, but it will help give our patients a better quality of life. It will help to make sure that they are taking their medications or following whatever parts of the treatment plan, whether it be for diet or exercise. There has to be a compromise. It can't just be what the textbook says the right answer is. And I think that not only goes for women or people of color, but for all patients.
And thank you so much for sharing this. And I know it's not easy for you. And we are going to kind of link up your Fix Talk just so that not only are you helping doctors and patients kind of struggle with having to deal with chronic disease, but also you're helping physicians understand what it's like from the patient perspective and how you describe that in this Fix Talk through, you know, your 5 lessons all doctors should walk away with to help build a better patient relationship. You talk about listening, you talk about waiting, you talk about autonomy, you talk about empathy, you talk about mentorship. And these are all things you've talked about today. And I found that so powerful as an educational tool to be a better physician and establish a better rapport with your patient, because they're going to, like you said in your talk, they're going to open up to you. They're going to tell you more. if you can do those things. And I think it gets missed a lot, especially with chronic disease and especially women with chronic disease.
Absolutely. I think that it was my rheumatologist who, after this incident with this internal medicine doctor, I finally talked to her on the phone. And again, as I said, she had us strike a compromise for me taking the steroids. And I told her about this experience that I had with this internal medicine doctor and how he's so sexist. He was only talking to my dad. He stopped talking to me. And she said, you are going to take that experience and you are going to remember it when you are a doctor. And from that point forward, all of the experiences that I had as myself as a patient, I tried to carry with me in my practice in medicine to remember what it felt like. And from that, I came up with these five lessons that, you know, I wanted my doctors to listen. When I first was being diagnosed, people, you know, I didn't know how to articulate my symptoms. It's very difficult. At that point, I didn't have that much medical knowledge. And I just know what I felt like and the feeling of pain or shortness of breath or any symptom is different in every person. And so my only way of describing what my legs felt like was to say to them that my legs feel like tree trunks. Jeans that I could wear 1 week, the next week I could not wear them anymore because they wouldn't fit. They felt and they looked like tree trunks. And that's all I was giving my physicians. And so in the beginning, there were many doctors that kind of just dismissed me like, okay, well, you have thick legs. And, you know, as a Black woman, I'm just like, okay, yes, I know I have thick legs, but there's something wrong with them. My legs were always thick. They didn't feel like this. And so it wasn't until I had this doctor who would actually listen to me and send the CPK, and which led to my final diagnosis. Really, I think the difference between him and the other physicians was that he actually just listened. He just sat there, and he was actually a gastroenterologist. And the reason why I was sent to him is because my AST and ALT were elevated. So they thought maybe there was something wrong with my liver. And it turned out it was my muscle, not my liver. But he just listened. He didn't do anything magically powerful, but to just listen. And I appreciated him. And from that point forward, I can say that the best physicians that I've had have just given me their time and attention. They may not have been able to heal me or cure me, or they may not have been able to give me, you know, some magic pill, but they just listened. And I walk away from those appointments feeling much better than the times where my doctors did not take the time to listen to me. And I'm coming back and it's like, you know, well, I told you that last appointment that I was experiencing this, or just being very dismissive of my symptoms, even if to this day I'm not able to fully articulate what those symptoms mean. And then I think that also goes to the point of waiting, right? You really do, especially in the emergency department, it's difficult, right? We can't sit there for an hour to listen to our patients tell us why they're there. We have a short, finite amount of time, but you can imagine if you're giving someone bad news and then you proceed to, you know, tell them, okay, well, I need you to sign this consent for a CAT scan, or, all right, so I'm going to discharge you now. Follow up with the oncology doctor. No one is going to remember anything that you said to them after you gave them that bad news. Your brain literally shuts down. It's a protective mechanism. And so all the times that I've gotten bad news, whether it be in the emergency department or admitted into the hospital or at an outpatient clinic appointment, I can't remember anything that happened afterwards. And so now when I approach my patient, I try to take a second to deliver the bad news and then wait. And everything after that, I really try to give piecemeal to the patient because I know that they may not process it. And if it's important discharge instructions that are really important, you have to write it down because the person is in shock or they're still trying to process the news that you gave them an hour ago. And so it's like little tips like that in being a patient that I quite remember. again, as I go back and I refer to that example of the doctor, the internal medicine doctor, who was basically just talking, he had stopped talking to me because I wasn't following his instructions and he was talking to my father. The autonomy to be able to just, I want to accept your treatment plan how I want to accept it. I may not accept the full treatment plan. I may not follow your instructions, but give me the autonomy to be able to decide how I want to care for myself. I think that's extremely important. And I try to remember that when I'm, you know, caring for my patients. They may say that they want to walk out AMA. And, you know, most times we get so upset. Oh my God, you're walking out AMA. How could you walk out AMA? Why did you even come here to begin with if you didn't want my help? But there might be a reason why they're walking out AMA. I tell my residents, why do most of our patients AMA around 2-3 o'clock? And they just look at me dumbfounded. I don't know why. Because they have to pick up their kids. So if they have to make the decision between leaving their kid alone at school waiting for them or their own health, they're going to always choose their kids. So just give them their that autonomy to make that decision and try to compromise with them and say, okay, I understand you have to pick up your kid, you have to leave now, but please either come back after you get them situated or here's a follow-up appointment or come and see me tomorrow. Patients want to take care of themselves. That's why they came to you. And then having the empathy, this is extremely important. I think, again, it starts with us having empathy for ourselves and allowing ourselves as physicians to be human. And then you can remember that your patients are human. We get into this rut, and this is not just a residency thing. It's an attending thing too, and it probably speaks a little to burnout, but you get into this rut where all of your patients are just diagnoses, and you forget that they're human, and they come with a family, and they come with their pets, and they come with their own priorities in life. And so just remember, your patient is human. And so if they, for example, want to sign out AMA because they have to take care of their cat, then understand that, like, that person is human and they really care for their cat. So maybe call their neighbor for them and say, listen, I'll call your neighbor to make sure that Fluffy is taken care of. Or just, you have no idea the decisions you're going to make or how you're going to process bad news yourself. And so I describe my most recent illness, which was organizing pneumonia, and how once I read that CAT scan, I completely shut down my medical brain. And all I knew was that I needed to leave. One, I was embarrassed that I was at work and I was sick. And again, that just is a testament to allowing ourselves to be human. I was scared and I just needed to go. And so I basically signed myself out AMA with organizing pneumonia, which would later be found as organizing pneumonia, and a moderate size pneumothorax. Now, if I were my patient, I would say, you are crazy. What are you doing? Not only that, I took a lift home and then the lift broke down. And so I was on the side of the street.
Oh my God.
Not being able to breathe. And I was like, oh my God, I'm going to die on the side of the road. And then it finally like came to me. I was like, I just need to go to the emergency department. So I took another lift to another emergency department and got cared for. But I realized that I was making decisions and judgment calls that were clearly not of a doctor who was an attending doctor practicing medicine for 8 years, who's a program director. Like, I was clearly not making appropriate decisions. And just imagine your patient, the shock of finding this out and just being scared. I thought I had cancer. Like, they may not make the best decisions in that moment, and that's okay. And so how do you work around that? Maybe you get their family involved, and maybe you know, tell them, okay, listen, I'm going to call you later. It's okay to call your patients once they leave the emergency department. Like, okay, you want to send us AMA, but can I give you a call later? There are just so many other things that we can do if we look at our patients as humans and not just as diagnoses. And I think that whether it be for burnout or whether it be until we experience things ourselves, whether it be tragedy or illness, that we kind of, it opens up our eyes like, oh my God, you know, this patient is human. And so from that point forward, once I eventually did come back to work, I would always think when patients signed out AMA, like, what's the reason behind this? Instead of getting upset about it, I would ask them why. And sometimes their reasoning, like, was clearly not an appropriate answer, but I would accept it and acknowledge it and try to give them alternatives, because I just know that feeling of being scared. And I would acknowledge that with them. Like, I realize you're scared. And sometimes that's all it takes, is to acknowledge their fear. Another point that I was trying to make in the fixed talk was that I think they're, you know, our emergency departments right now in the United States are oftentimes being used as primary care access. And they shouldn't be. And we all know that. And we, you know, some of us didn't really go into emergency medicine to take care of primary care complaints. But that actually is our job. And I will say that in that moment, when the patient is coming to you, they don't have the medical vocabulary or the medical knowledge. Whatever they're coming to you with is an emergency to them. It might be a bit of a cough or a cold, and you're like, well, why are you here for a cold? Just take a lozenge and go home. But that is important to them. For them, they're sick and they're asking for your help. And so what you know, you may not be able to heal their cold in that moment or their virus, but you can give them a primary care doctor. And that is a huge step for them, because maybe they don't go to the doctor. And so instead of getting upset and saying, I don't even know why this person is here, just remember that they're there for your help, and that everything is an emergency to them because they don't have the knowledge. So it's, you know, behooves us as emergency physicians to explain to them, you know, why this can either be treated at home or I can go to the primary care doctor, instead of getting frustrated as to why they're in your emergency department. I think that's another aspect of empathy that we all need to have.
My last point that I made at Fix was about mentorship, and it's kind of this description of what happened to me during one of my time periods of relapse from my autoimmune illness. And it's probably also one of the reasons why I didn't tell people that I was suffering from these medical chronic illnesses, is because it carried so much judgment. And so when I went in to speak to this program director, and he told me that he didn't think that I was strong enough to be an emergency physician. In all honesty, at that moment, I wasn't strong enough, but that's not what I needed to hear. I needed to hear to either wait or to get better or to find strength to move forward, but not to shut me down. And I've definitely, as a patient and as a physician patient, there have been many times where I've encountered either doctors that were treating me or supposedly mentoring me who have shut me down because of my disability. You know, I've had people tell me that I shouldn't be an emergency physician. I should be a radiologist because that's less stressful and people with autoimmune diseases can't deal with stress. Or because of all the immunosuppressive medications, they shouldn't be working in a hospital environment. I've had people tell me that I shouldn't be program director for some of the same reasons. And I just remembered all of that when I stepped into the position of being the program director. And I remembered his conversation, which, to be honest, motivated me to get better. After that one meeting, I spent the rest of my career trying to prove this one program director wrong, that not only can I finish, but I'm going to become a program director just like you, and I'll show you. Meanwhile, this man has no idea or remembers the conversation at all with me. But my point is that I remember these incidences where I was told no, or I faced discrimination. And as a program director, I vowed to my residents that I would do for them what I thought he should have done for me that day, which is to say, you know, yes, you're tired. Yes, you're hungry. Yes, you're confused. You're scared. And these are all human conditions, right? It's okay to be human, but you can do it. Because I know that if I could come from my night shift, get IVIG, or at one point I was getting chemo, and then go back to my next night shift, if I can do that, you can do it too. And sometimes we don't know what our residents are facing, whether it's financial difficulties or, they're in the middle of a, you know, a bad relationship. You have no idea. But if you allow your resident to be human and you push them and let them be vulnerable, I've found that one, they open up to you and you can help them with whatever their issues are, but then you can push them to move forward. And also just give them a mirror to say, do you see how you're feeling? Now imagine how your patient is feeling. I'm sure your patient who's coming in screaming, maybe they've gone through some of the same things. Maybe they're, you know, being abused at home. Maybe they have a drug or an alcohol problem, and you have a cousin who has the same thing. Like, just use those bad times in your life to help others, because that's what we all signed up for as physicians. And so I tried to use all of the bad moments in my life as that I had come to at this point as a program director and try to spin it. As Beyonce says, try to make lemonade out of lemons. And so I wanted to really help other people. And I hope that I have done that up until this point. Again, I think it's like a 360 moment for me, being able, once hiding my medical condition, to now being able to openly talk about it and to help others who are also dealing with chronic medical illnesses, both as physicians and as patients. It really is honestly a 360 moment for me.
Can improving the gender gap in the workplace for our physicians affect patients' outcome? Well, yes, there's evidence to support this. On a previous episode, Dr. Esther Chu discussed a study out of Florida that shows when you increase the number of women faculty in the emergency department, patient outcomes improve. This holds both for when patients are being treated directly by women, but also when they're being treated directly by men as well.
And so I really think this is about but all workers in healthcare. And then more than that, because of what we do in this field, it's actually about our patients, because we want a strong, well-supported, fully engaged, productive workforce to take the best care of patients that we can. And so I would end with one piece of data, which was a recent study, a large Florida data set of patients who presented to the emergency department with MI. This was published in PNAS, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And this was a very large data set of MI patients in Florida hospitals. And they showed that when you brought more women into an emergency department, the survival for heart attack patients improved. And it didn't just improve for patients taken care of by women physicians. It improved for patients taken care of by male physicians. So you increase the presence of women in the workplace, and then it's better for the patients they care for. And it was just a really beautiful and elegant example of how diversity has so many dividends in unexpected ways. So we're not trying to impose a unilateral burden just so that everybody feels good. This is really about improving all the things that we care about in healthcare, including the quality of the care that we deliver and lives, literally lives saved.
Today, we took you through some studies that show that patient care is affected by gender bias. And we heard firsthand from a physician about her difficult experience as a patient and how bias was detrimental to her healthcare. One more compelling reason to get motivated to make gender equity a priority for everyone.
Well, Laura, that wraps it up for the first season of Closing the Gap. In season two, we'll focus on some of the specific ways that gender bias affect women physicians, the pay gap, the motherhood penalty, the promotional squeeze, sexual harassment, and more.
And for our third and final season, we have episodes dedicated to the solutions to these important issues, not only for individuals, but also for groups and systems. But first, look out for season two, and it'll be coming out soon.
Special thanks to everyone who's contributed to this project, including our editor and producer, Stacey Gitlin, our research and writing team, Dr. Samruti Desai, Dr. Rachel Bridwell, Dr. Elizabeth Dubay, Dr. Danielle Zeal, Dr. Aaron Hanlon, Dr. Rachel Ely, Dr. Zachary Baker, and Dr. Claremont Venditti.
Shout out to our graphic designer, Dr. David Burkholder, and thank you to our sponsors, Medical Center Emergency Services, a Democratic, not-for-profit EM group in Detroit, and Feminem.
I'm Amber Sobrario.
And I'm Laura Smiley. Please join us next season on Closing the Gap.